Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. Today is our Valentine to the Criterion Collection. Joining me is film critic, comics writer, and podcaster Will Pfeiffer to talk about our favorite Criterions and the recently released Dr. Strangelove. We'll also talk about some of Will's comic work, including Finals with Jill Thompson, and the DC Comics series Hero. We end by talking about Will's movie podcast Out of Theaters, which is currently on hiatus, but as you will hear, is coming back in the near future. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. This is a podcast we've been planning on doing ever since the show launched last year. It's our salute to the Criterion Collection, and it just happens to be timed just as Barnes & Noble kicked off their annual 50% off sale. To talk about how great the Criterions are, including the just-released Dr. Strangelove and some other stuff, is film critic, comic book writer, and podcaster Will Pfeiffer. How's it going, Will?
Marketing. It's going well. The Criterion sale's on. How could it not be going well?
And just in time, Strangelove came out, I think, last week.
Yeah.
The In-Laws, which is a great movie with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin, I believe, came out earlier this week. Plus,
came out this week.
Plus, there's, 800-ish other movies for people to pick from.
Oh yeah, they usually schedule it. They'll make sure there's a couple sort of high profile items when they schedule that sale. And I mean, Strangelove is it's one of the all time greats, and The In-Laws is one of those all time great comedies that maybe you haven't heard of, but boy, you should, because it's funny.
I just remember the old days when you could actually keep up with Criterion. I think in the last 5 years maybe, it's just become. I remember there used to be, say, like 3 or 4 a month, I think, if that. So it was reasonable to keep up, and I was lucky that I was working at Borders, and so,
nice.
Most of the time the Criterion, the first time they came in, didn't make it to the floor.
Of course.
Between me or some of my other friends who would be like, save this for me, and then, so the store would get 2 or 3 sales immediately off whatever came out, and There were enough of them coming out that you could buy everything, even if you didn't necessarily want an obscure American movie or a movie from the Middle East or maybe a Japanese movie that wasn't Kurosawa or Ozu. You're just like, I'm a collector. I got to have them all, including, the out-of-print ones. But now it's so – they're so voluminous. You just got to pick and choose what you want.
Oh, there's tons. I would never even try to buy them all, but – I had a glorious time a few years ago when I was a DVD critic for a newspaper here in Rockford, Illinois, and somehow I managed to get on Criterion's list. So every month I'd get an email, and they wouldn't send me everything, but they would say, let us know which one or two you'd be interested in reviewing, and be like, oh, now I have to choose, and build up a nice collection that way.
Yeah, I think I've also over the years sold off some of mine by now. Now that everything's much more readily available, that some of the early ones that are out of print, I remember for a while, like the John Woo one, and
yeah, I've got the John Woo one still. I've hung on to those, even though there's probably better versions of them out now.
Well, I think that's probably the same way it is with the Criterion RoboCop. There's probably a Bells and Whistles edition now, but, there was and Silence of the Lambs probably probably falls in that category, too. One of the things that we had sort of pre-planned to talk about was, what's your favorite Criterion? And I don't necessarily mean the movie.
Right.
But it's movie plus packaging plus extras. I'm a sucker for extras.
Oh, yeah.
I'm one of those people that if there's a movie that I really like and it comes out on DVD or Blu-ray, but there aren't very many extras, I'll be like, well, I've seen it already. Do I really need to buy this? And, you know, I think the only things that I really have to buy are, you know, are Tarantino movies. And Tarantino doesn't usually have a whole lot of extras.
No, his are pretty bare-boned, considering.
And it's somebody you would think would love having tons of extras, being a film nerd himself.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, here's one thing, and I do love the extras, and, I mean, for a long time, that's what Criterion was really known for, as being the company that would give you a lot of extras. But I have to say, sadly, that as I get older and, you know, I've got a kid, and I find myself watching the extras a lot less than I used to, but I still like to make time for them.
I definitely look at the packaging and I say, does this have commentary?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of extras? And I love, there's been a bunch over the years where, especially things from the Golden Age of Hollywood, where they put on the Lux Radio adaptation.
Right, right. They do that. I think they did that with the Only Angels Have Wings just came out recently that I haven't had a chance to pick up yet, but I'm definitely going to.
Yeah, and that has art by Francisco Francavilla.
Right, right.
Who, the comics artist that people may know that did a bunch of Batman stuff and is drawing the Afterlife with Archie book
mm-hmm,
now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if I said what's one the one criterion you could if you have to get rid of all your other ones,
oh,
what's
man,
the
this
one
is hard.
That, well, I was gonna say I can expand it to a couple, but what's do you know what number one is, or do you have to, is it one of those things that changes depending on your mood?
It changes a little, but I do have a good contender both for the movie itself and for the extras. And I would say at this moment in time, although like we said, it shifts, I would go with their Blu-ray of Night of the Hunter that came out a couple years ago. 1955 movie, only movie Charles Laughton ever directed, stars Robert Mitchum. It's a strange movie. It's like a horror movie, a film noir, a fairy tale, sort of all mixed. And I love the movie. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. Plus, the DVD has, you know, has commentary. You know, it has documentaries. It has an Ed Sullivan Show clip with the members of the cast performing a deleted scene. But what really kills it on this is it has an entire disc, a bonus disc, with 2.5 hours of the filming of the movie, like behind the scenes, outtakes, and footage of Lawton actually directing. I mean, I've never seen that with any other movie. And the fact that it's one of my favorite movies of all time just makes it it's just such a great package.
And, of course, if people have never seen it, that's where probably one of the most copied things in popular culture is the Robert Mitchum, the crazy criminal preacher,
mm-hmm.
has love and hate tattooed on his fingers. That's where that comes from,
that's
if you've ever seen.
We got it. That's right.
I know that, like everything, it's been in The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. And
Sideshow Bob has it tattooed
right.
on his hands in the Cape Fear episode.
But he only has three fingers, so it's like shortened, isn't it?
It's L U V,
right.
And H with a line over it.
It's a long A sound. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was also in Do the Right Thing.
Uh huh. Yeah, Radio Raheem has it.
Radio Raheem has it, and. There's
a Clash song where they refer to a guy having love and hate tattooed across the knuckles of his hands, and they must have got it from this too. So.
Right. If I were to pick one, and again, I like you, it would change.
It's hard,
but for the sheer scope, and especially for when it came out, and it's I think a fairly low number.
Uh-huh.
I would still have to go with Brazil.
Oh, that was a contender.
Because it's three discs, it's filled with extras, it has Gilliam's version of the movie,
mm-hmm.
it has the studio-edited version, which is called the Love Conquers All print.
Right, right.
And then there's, like, I believe there's, like, an entire documentary about all the things that went wrong with that movie and the fights.
Battle of Brazil documentary.
Right. So that's a humongous three-disc set that I think, to me, that sort of encapsulates what Criterion is.
It is. That's a good one. And you know that Love Conquers All, when I first heard it was on the set, I'm like, well, I'm never going to watch this. Because there was a time in my life when I was in college that Brazil was my all-time favorite movie. And but the Love Conquers All has a great commentary track where they explain both the big and little changes the studio made that sort of took the heart out of Gillian's movie. So it's weirdly fascinating in its own right.
One of the other contenders I think is great just because it was so different than your typical Criterion release, and it was a fairly early one, and I think it's out of print, is the Beastie Boys video anthology.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good call, too. I don't know if it's out of print or not. It's not on Blu-ray, though. I mean, they haven't released it on Blu-ray.
I just remember the great thing about that, and it's what you would expect. It's two or three discs of all the Beastie Boy videos with all the remixes, and I think some of them have commentary.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember it was so weird because it was this weird menu-driven disc where you had to, like, pick something, and then you picked something else, and then it was like three or four stages for you to get through before you actually got to see the video.
They make you work for it.
Yeah, and some of the other ones that I just sort of dashed down, that would be probably in my top five.
Another? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. Pick
I was gonna, the pick one I, another one I thought of most, because we're talking about the extras, is Carnival of Souls, which is it was an independent horror movie made by a guy named Herc Harvey back in the early 60s. Very moody, black and white, beautiful film. And the disc has both the original version, the theatrical cut, but it also has, because Herc Harvey worked for a company that made educational films, it also has like a whole section of films that he made, you know, films about teenagers and how to get along in your classmates and that kind of thing. And it's just a fascinating package of a guy, you know, he only made one movie and nobody ever heard of him, but it's almost like a great little tribute to this guy, Herc Harvey, all in one disc set. I have it on DVD, but I'm pretty sure it's coming out very soon on Blu-ray if it hasn't come out already.
Yeah, that's another thing it's hard to keep track of, the re-releases and with new covers and that kind of thing. Sometimes I've been hesitant to sort of quote-unquote upgrade.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's one that I did, and I'm glad I did, because I think there's more extras on the new version, is The Third Man.
Oh,
which is,
yeah,
you know, which is such a great movie in and of itself. And, you know, it's Orson Welles and Vienna and the Zither and
mm-hmm.
Joseph Cotten
mm-hmm.
and that's where, you know, Harvey Lime. That's another one that's full of radio stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's got that's a good pick. That's such a great movie.
But, the one that I was going to mention a while ago, again, sort of taking things that aren't your typical. I mean, we can easily say, you know, any of the, like, six or seven Truffaut movies or the four or five Kurosawa movies, you know, are all sort of obvious choices. But to me, and this is something I loved as a teenager that came out a while because it was never available, is Tanner 88.
I have that right on my shelf over there. That's a good one. Especially this year, that's a good one.
Which was an HBO miniseries, basically. It was about a fictional presidential candidate. And they shot it like on the convention trail with this guy doing stuff, and it's Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau.
Right, yeah, dudes are
known. Yeah, and you think about sort of, you know, 1988, you know, Altman had kind of dipped and hadn't had his renaissance mm-hmm. again, you know, and Doonesbury was certainly chugging along in the 80s, and I remember it being, you know, chock full of, I think Michael Murphy plays Tanner, if I remember right. And, you know, there's there's a bunch of people you would recognize. And that's something that it's great to see him do that. And then you sort of look a couple years later, and I don't remember if he's in it, but Bob Roberts, which is a movie I love, which came out when I was in college.
Yeah, I love that
movie too. Which is like the spiritual descendant of that because, you know, Tim Robbins had sort of become part of the Altman troupe, and they had just made The Player, which also just came out on
yeah,
Criterion
that just came out,
a couple weeks ago, which is another great movie. But yeah, but I remember that was so different for, and it was on TV and it was on HBO, and that's something that's great that it's collected, and it's great that it got the Criterion treatment too.
Yeah, it's fascinating because that's the one where, I mean, it was scripted obviously, but then there was some improv, and they would have people like Bob Dole is in an episode, and maybe Gary Hart. I mean, whoever was running for president back in 1988. It's a sort of interesting record of that time. Yeah, that's a good call because that's one people never remember, I don't think.
The only other thing that I wanted to mention, and I guess it used to be, like we were saying, Criterion, when you think about it, used to think of Truffaut and Godard and Kurosawa and Kubrick to a lesser extent. But now, contemporarily, when I say Criterion, I think Wes Anderson.
Yeah, because, yeah. They're like,
because,
studio, sort of.
Yeah, it seems like whenever he puts something out, there's a sort of regular studio version, and then maybe like a year or two later, there's a Criterion edition. So, because I think the most recent one is Moonrise Kingdom, so probably sometime next year, we'll probably get a Criterion Grand Budapest Hotel.
I hope so. I think Grand Budapest, I think that's one of Wes Anderson's best movies, and actually, I got the Blu-ray because I just wanted to have it on a nice, crisp Blu-ray. But yeah, if Criterion puts that out, I will definitely upgrade on that one.
One of the things I was looking at my list when I was looking for things that were atypical is the Criterion Fantastic Mr. Fox has a lot of the making of the animation and all that other kind of stuff that went into making that movie, plus extras and the usual rigmarole.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I don't think you can go bad with a Wes Anderson movie. I mean, maybe Darjeeling Limited, I think, might be...
That might be his weakest, but even that's a heck of a movie, too, you know? And the Criterion Rushmore, it has the Wes Anderson shorts that he did for the MTV Movie Awards way back when, but they're, you know, it's nice. They're captured on the disc there. The Max Fisher players and that. Yeah. They do a nice job with Wes's stuff.
Yeah. I would, I mean, for me personally, I think Rushmore and Tannenbaum are like the two best movies, with Hotel being like a little below them. And then sort of the other ones, you know, a little, again, I don't think any of them are bad.
No.
It's just when you rank them, something has to be at the top and something has to be at the bottom. But yeah, I love Tannenbaum's and I love Rushmore.
And I've got a sweet spot for Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Although I know a lot of people aren't wild about that one, but I do like that one.
See, I am not the world's biggest Bill Murray fan.
Oh well, then I could see why.
so Zissou plus, you know, the Wilsons and the. I mean, I think the thing I like most about Zissou is the weird Portuguese David Bowie songs.
Oh, that's something.
Which is just, it's such a weird Wes Anderson kind of thing.
Right, it's so bizarre. Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, it is. As soon as you say that, you'd be like, well, that must be a Wes Anderson movie.
Well, I think one of the greatest things, have you ever seen that Saturday Night Live parody where it's like the Wes Anderson horror movie?
I forget what it's called, but I know exactly which one you mean. Oh, it's great.
Yeah, it's really well. Yeah, I will. If I remember, I will throw that in the show notes.
You know, one other your Tanner comment reminded me. Have you ever seen the Golden Age of Television box that they did?
Yeah,
that's a good
that's
one.
Great too.
Yeah, it's got how many? It's like three discs. It's got, I can't even remember how, but it's just several original Kinescope of the live broadcasts of things like Marty, No Time for Sergeant, Patterns, Requiem for a Heavy Eight, all as they were originally broadcast in the '50s, and it's really good stuff. I mean, big stars in it, and it's got a real live TV edginess to it. It's a really fascinating artifact, plus interviews with the cast and all kinds of commentary tracks. So it's a good one. And it's, like Tanner, atypical for the collection.
Before we move on, I guess we should probably talk a little about Strangelove, since it's the one that just came out. I watched it the other day, and I've probably seen it a handful of times over the years. Certainly saw it in film class. Because I think that's one of those movies, almost like Kane, where no matter how many times you watch it, you find new stuff in
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. I would,
especially, you know, with this great new print. I think you can see, you know, because I certainly have probably seen like bad film class prints where you can't, you know, you can barely make stuff out. But this is so clear that you can see some of the stuff that's like going on in the war room. You can see stuff in the background that you may not have noticed. Like, I think there's sometimes when guys are talking in the foreground, you can see people in the back pointing, or I think.
Well, Peter Bull is, as the Russian ambassador, he's notoriously trying hard not to completely break up laughing while Sellers is doing his Strangelove rant.
Yeah, I think there's one when Peter Sellers is on the phone as the president, and you can see Georgie Scott in the background sort of pointing and gesticulating because, you know, he's getting madder and madder about, you know, the president spilling the beans to the Russians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, see, and George C. Scott is so good in that movie. I mean, supposedly Kubrick only used, like, the most over-the-top takes, which pissed off Scott, but it works. It works beautifully.
And it's funny because you don't normally think of George C. Scott doing comedy.
No,
but he
you
is,
do not.
he's funny. I mean, Sterling Hayden is funny, just being totally deadpan crazy. Slim Pickens is Slim Pickens being Slim Pickens,
so
which is great.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he was fairly obscure, and Kubrick had just picked him out to put him in this movie. Because
he was kind of like a cowboy-type guy, and they wanted, you know, for him to be a cowboy-type character. So, yeah, I think it was one of his first big breaks, I think.
The other funny thing is seeing James Earl Jones,
mm-hmm.
you know, as one of the members of the flight crew.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like,
he's so
it's
fun.
Just funny. It's like, what's James Earl Jones doing in this movie?
I remember watching this movie, man. I've seen it tons of times ever since I was in high school. And I remember watching it with someone once many years ago who had never seen it before and didn't really know much about it. And you could tell that right up until the end, they were trying to figure out how nuclear war was going to be averted. They figured in their head, well, this obviously isn't going to end with the end of the world, so how are they going to save humanity? And then when it didn't get saved, they were a little, like, taken aback. Oh, spoilers, by the way.
Well, it's, you know, and again, it's such a contemporary thing where you had, I think this came out before Failsafe, but that's,
mm-hmm.
but they're like, the two movies are very interesting to watch as a parallel.
Right.
Because it's sort of the same topic. But, yeah, certainly if people have never seen Strangelove, it's
so good.
It's so good. It's Peter Sellers. Like, if your opinion of Peter Sellers has, like, only been, your only exposure, I guess, has been to Pink Panther. And I guess now probably that's not true anymore.
Well, when I first saw this, that was my only exposure to Peter Sellers. I knew him from the Pink Panther movies, which I saw as a kid. Yeah, this is a revelation.
And there's so much hidden I guess I would say hidden context, but it's not. There's a lot of it that isn't really subtle. I mean, it's a whole movie basically about sex,
exactly, and impotence and male frustration, and that brings about the apocalypse.
But yeah, it's the kind of thing where you need to just do a deep dive on the internet about. You know, it starts with the there's stock footage of the planes refueling,
right.
Which is a sexual metaphor.
It's so sexual. It's almost amazing that it had aired in I mean, really, all it is just planes, but it just has this aura of sex about it. The music playing and everything.
Yeah, to go on that, and you've got people, you know, people's names are not really very subtle, where it's, you know, murky, you know, Merkin Muffy, you know, and
for president, Buck Turgidson.
Buck Turgidson. And then Sterling Hayden's character is Jack D. Ripper. It's like,
right.
It's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, I'm going to put this guy in charge of an army base. What's his name? Jack D. Ripper.
That'll go well. That'll go well. The thing is,
and
about
of course, I was just going to point out the great irony of the crazy hawk general in this movie is somebody that was on the Hollywood banned list for
mm-hmm.
being a communist sympathizer.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
Which presumably contemporary audiences would have known, which makes the joke even funnier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would have, back then they would have been, yeah, they would have known all about Sterling Hayden. So that's, and it's, what I was going to say is it's like, it's a comedy, and at times it's very funny. Plus, it's from Kubrick, so it looks amazing. But it's also like really suspenseful in parts. Like when they're, you know, the plane is flying over Russia and you're wondering if they're going to drop the bomb and the plane, the other squadrons are attacking. It's, you know, you're on the edge of your seat. I, even no matter how many times you've seen it, it just works in every possible way.
And it's funny that those scenes of the plane, I guess there's some sort of, you know, projection, but it looks very accomplished for like 1962, 1963.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just right, and it's got that great black and white look. Apparently, the production designer Ken Adam, he was actually investigated by the FBI or whoever it was. Because the RAF maybe, or where they filmed it, because the inside of the bomber was so, it looked so accurate, they thought he had accessed some stolen plans or classified documents, and it was, he just kind of faked it, but it just looks that real, that's what the inside of a plane looks like.
I think one of the articles that comes with the DVD says, or it may have been in the commentary, that there apparently was one public photo of what the inside of the bomber looked like.
Yeah, that's
what they went on. but the other thing is, when they were filming the plane, the footage of the plane, or the stock footage that they superimposed the plane over, I guess they were flying in Greenland, and I guess apparently a couple times ventured into like Air Force space. So they had, you know, they had to explain, oh, we're just making a movie. But yeah, it's funny that this is the kind of movie that would end up being flagged a couple times. And there's, and like we said, this is 1963, and like the Manchurian Candidate ended up being affected by the JFK assassination.
Right,
because
right.
At one point, when they're opening their boxes on their survival boxes on the plane, which includes like a pistol, and then a bunch of drugs, including like penicillin, and there's nylon stockings and condoms
lipstick
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Slim Pickens says, this would be good to have for a weekend in Vegas.
Yeah, a fella could have a pretty good time in Vegas with this stuff or something like that. Yeah. But
apparently,
yeah.
Yeah
<tell him.
laughs> But when they made it, he actually said Dallas.
Right.
And so since this came out, I think after the assassination, he dubbed over Vegas. So when you're watching it, you can see him say Dallas, but he says Vegas.
Right, right, right.
And if you don't know the difference, then, you know, it wouldn't be anything. But yes.
Well, and then also at the end, there's this legendary scene that was filmed but never included, where there was a giant pie fight in the war room. And you can see in the existing footage, like, some pies on tables. And I guess, I don't know if they took it out because Kubrick just felt it didn't work, but there was at one point, the president got hit with a pie, and George C. Scott says, like, our young president has been struck down in his prime, and that had a whole different meaning after, you know, November 22nd, 1963, so that was eliminated, too.
Yeah, it's funny because there's a scene where there's a buffet,
right.
And you're like, why is there a buffet in the war room?
Yeah, the war room looks pretty sweet.
And that's another thing, you were talking about Ken Adam. Basically, Kubrick hired him based on Ken Adam's set designs for Dr. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, the war room really does sort of look like something you'd find at the bottom of Blofeld's volcano.
Oh, completely, yeah.
Which, you know, is another sort of, you know, not too subtle, who's the bad guy, who's the good guy in all of this. And, yeah, and like we were saying, there's a bunch of good supplemental material with his disc. I think my favorite is there's a little copy of the Russian phrasebook and Holy Bible that's like about an inch square.
I've heard about this.
That you see in the movie. Yeah, so there's a little like 1 by 1.5 inch little thing. Like in the front, it's got a couple of the Russian phrases, and the rest of it is like stuff about the movie. Like, it's not a complete Russian phrasebook and Bible, but it looks like the one you
right.
see in the movie, which I think is such a great touch.
Oh, that's nice. That alone makes it worth picking up.
Right. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is some of your comics work. You recently finished your run on Teen Titans, right? With when Rebirth started.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to think. My last issue. It was a few months ago. It came out. But yeah, I had a Just under 20 issues, I think I did on the Old Titans.
Right. Some of the stuff that you've done is you've done Aquaman. Mm-hmm. You had a long run on Catwoman, one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Teen Titans. You did. People may remember Amazon's attack from a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. The two things that I wanted to, actually, well, we'll talk since we're talking about film. When you were writing Catwoman, you resurrected this very obscure 80s villain,
right?
called the Film Freak, mm-hmm. which I thought that was a great arc at the time, and I don't know if I knew then that, you know, you were a film critic and you had all this history. So I presume you had a ball writing this over-the-top metatextual kind of bad guy.
Oh, completely. I mean, I was looking, obviously you're always looking for villains, and I knew that there had been a character called the Film Freak, but frankly, all I took was the name. I gave him like a new identity and a new, he was like, you know, in the Batman universe, everyone's got their little gimmick. So his was, he was a huge, you know, movie expert, and he used that in his crimes. And yeah, needless to say, I mean, that's like my favorite thing I think I ever did on Catwoman was that little arc with him. Cause I could get in so many movie references and make so many movie jokes. And it ends, there's like a strange love thing at the end with she has to defuse an atomic bomb. And so I put in a bunch of strange love quotes.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was, I think this was your first book, was when you did Finals, mm-hmm. with my Lucha watching buddy, Jill Thompson.
That's right.
How did that come? Was that your entry into comics?
That was the first thing I ever wrote. Yeah. That was for Vertigo back in 1999. It was published, and I had known Jill for years. I knew Jill when I was back in college at Kent State in the late 80s, because she was friends with a friend of mine, and she moved to Kent for a while. Then I graduated, got a job out in Rockford, Illinois. She moved back to Chicago, where she was originally from. And so I had this idea for just like, you know, a book about college, but everything is taken to the most extreme level that it could be taken. And I talked to Jill about it. We bounced around a ton of ideas, and yeah, it took a while, but eventually Vertigo picked it up, and that was my debut in the world of comics.
Yeah, for people who haven't seen it, it is a very, very dark, dark comedy about this, like the senior year at this fictional Midwestern college where, you know, people are killing each other, and there's cults and time machines and bank robbers. It's extremely over the top, but it's because I read it a couple of days. I reread it a couple of days ago, and it's very funny.
Thanks.
But it's pretty
dark. It's
pretty
little,
darn dark.
Although people always, because I was like, you know, I was on the inside. I always think of it as more of just not not comedy, and I kind of forget just how dark it reads when you read it. But yeah, it's pretty dark. But it's all like. I mean, it's not autobiographical, but, you know, a lot of the little touches, you know, the house they live in is exactly, it's drawn to be the house I lived in. The campus is Kent State. I mean, it's all very much the townies versus the students kind of a thing. So it's a weirdly autobiographical comic where almost everybody is dead by the last scene. And it's funny.
But yeah, as somebody who went to, like, undergrad in Indiana, and then went to grad school at Bowling Green, I can certainly sort of recognize the kind of geography, you know, mm-hmm. the Midwestern mm-hmm. kind of sensibilities, whatever. And that, I believe, is available on Comixology.
It is, yeah.
If people want to take a look. The other book that I really loved at the time, and again, I reread earlier this week, is you sort of updated Dial H for Hero.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a two year run on the book. How did that book come about?
Well, I'd done Finals, but that was Vertigo. So that was, you know, the Vertigo and the DC back then were very sort of separate universes. But I had done some like short stories and one shots for the superhero end. And I was talking to an editor there, Mike McAvaney, and he said, yeah, DC's, we kind of want to redo the old Hero comic. Did you ever read that? And I'm like, yeah, because I saw some of the originals in reprints, but then they did a version in the 80s where readers sent in their own ideas, and I remember like reading that and thinking I should send something in, but of course I never did. But he wanted me to pitch for it, so I came up with the concept, and they liked it. So I had a great time on that book because it was like it was never the same character twice. You could mess with the powers. You could tell like a funny story or a serious story or a sad story. And yeah, I loved writing Hero. That was great.
Do you know the great story about the 80s Dial H for Hero?
Which one?
Is
it the Harlan Ellison one?
Yeah, that was Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, they resurrected Dial H for Hero in the 80s as a backup strip in Adventure Comics
right before
it became the Digest. And so the gimmick was people could send in their ideas. It was like they printed for a while. They printed like a blank sheet that had like an outline of a character, and you sort of had to come up with the name and draw the costume and then what kind of powers, and you filled out this form. And so most of the characters they ended up using were like, you know, here's the pile driver,
right.
And it was created by little Johnny Smith, like age 10, you know, from. You know, Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah, there'd be a little caption they'd run with. And they were only in, like, a scene or two, because they would change and then change back. And
yeah, they would go through, like, four or five characters, because there was a... Instead of in the 60s, where there's just the one kid, in the 80s version, there's a boy and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so they went through probably, like, five or six characters each, you know, like, eight-page story. So you get this, you know, Jimmy Smith and, you know... Mary Sue Jones from, you know, Long Beach or whatever. And then there's one issue where it's from Harlan Ellison, age like 56,
yeah.
Los Angeles. But that's so great because that's the kind of sort of subversive thing you could see Harlan doing.
And I think his character, I want to say this, I might be wrong. I think his character is named the Flying Buttress. Which, when I was a kid, I thought that was the weirdest name ever. But it's an architectural term. It's a, you know, a brace that comes out of a building. But only Harlan would do that.
Yeah, and then in your version, you brought back Robbie Reed, who was the star of the book in the 60s version.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I guess he's redeemed at the end, but. He's kind of a sort of bad guy when he gets introduced and then sort of has this redemptive arc.
Right. He's kind of playing the long game. Yeah, he's trying to track down the dial. And I always have to give DC credit because, I mean, the book had its, you know, like most comics, it started off, the sales are strong, and after a while that kind of petered out a little. But they gave us plenty of warning, so I was actually able to, you know, kind of tell a complete story instead of just, you know, it just kind of stopped one issue. So I was always... happy about that. Actually, they did one trade paperback collection of the first, I think, six issues, but that's the one comic of mine that I had bound. I had all 22 issues bound just so I could read it like as one story if I ever want to.
But yeah, like you said, there's a couple – it's the kind of thing now. I only read a couple issues when China Melville was doing it a couple years ago. But that's the kind of thing that, yeah, it seems like there's such a – blank slate because you did the one where there's this, it's sort of like, oh God, I don't remember what that movie was called, but you sort of did the version where there's a sexist pig guy who gets the dial and he turns into a giant buxom blonde that looks like Power Girl, and so you could deal with sexism or whatever,
I wonder how that reads now. It seems like the world has really changed since we did those three issues. But I was curious. We were being sensitive, I would like to think. You know, we weren't being, you know, we were definitely on the side of, you know, not being a big sexist pig, so.
No, but I'm sure that's the kind of thing where there were, like everything, there would probably be a portion of the readership who would find something to be offended by. Because
the comic readership?
That's how comic books are in 2016.
Of course. That's how everything is in 2016.
I was going to say, you sort of had to – I don't remember the details, but I sort of remember Amazon's attack kind of had some sort of foofarall about it,
if I
remember right. So you've lived through – you lived through that.
But it's, yeah, I mean, but, you know, that you put the work out and people are going to like it and people aren't going to like it. And, I mean, that's fine. It's the only thing, and this hasn't really affected me, but the only thing is now in this internet age, when some people, like, you know, with the Captain America storyline that, you know, the first issue, always been a Hydra agent all along, and people are, like, emailing death threats to the author. I mean, no, come on, people. That's just crazy. Calm down. Oh.
Well, the best part is people complaining to people that don't write the book anymore.
Right, yeah. And those people making the complaints, they didn't read the book either. I'm sure they read some BuzzFeed headline about Captain America's a Nazi now, and, you know.
Yeah. It's like, and I think probably most everybody that is, like, inside the comic book bubble said, there's 9 different ways that this can be explained, none of which actually is involved, you know, him turning heel.
Right.
You know, it's not really him, it's a different guy, it's a clone, mind control. And I think, you know, Cosmic Cube, which is apparently what it's turned out to be, which made sense because this was all built around the arc with the Cosmic Cube that was a little girl, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like, because I have friends that do comic book podcasts, and it seems like, yeah, every week they can be guaranteed that one of the stories in their news segment will be somebody complaining about something, whether it's quote-unquote legitimate or not. And I'm sure this week will be, I guess there's going to be a new Iron Man.
Who's like a 15-year-old African-American girl, and so.
Yeah, so people are all wigged out, and it's like.
Of course they are. Why wouldn't they be?
It's the kind of thing where it's like, I tell people sometimes, you know, like, my sort of new reading ebbs and flows as it goes, mainstream, indie, back and forth, and it's like, sometimes it's like, you know, I have 70 years worth of books that I could be reading.
Right.
That, you know, that are just, sometimes it's refreshing that it's just, you have a nice, straightforward, here's a good guy, here's a bad guy, you know, something weird happens, and it's resolved in 16 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's nice.
Yeah, oh yeah.
As opposed, you know, there's no hyper-violence, nobody's arms are getting ripped off, or, you know, no political subtext or whatever. It's
just a simple story. Just, I mean, it's with Hero, we did that. I was also to say, you know, we did that with Hero, but then in the end, we did have people's arms getting ripped off, so there's a little above.
But I would say, since I just read these the other day, that, you know, that sort of fit within the story, because, you know, you get to the point where you have, like, somebody who, you know, like, when you get a bad guy who gets a hold of the dial, and, you know, they're going to do bad stuff, and then you've got to fight, and blah, 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 and I must say, I love the idea of, and again, this sort of contradicts what I just said, but as a one-page gag, I think it's funny that to try and get the guy to dial the hero backwards to lose his powers, it's like, oh, we'll just take his hand off.
Yeah, yeah, I figured if.
And then we'll just use his hand, I'll hold his hand and dial it, and that worked. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that's sort of a strange analogy, but that's the equivalent of, like, when Superman used to get Mixelplick to say his name
right,
backwards.
Right, right. And that's the kind of trick we could only pull toward the end of the series, because then other people would be like, oh, you know, you want to do that all the time, and that's not going to work.
Do you have any books coming out in the future?
I don't have anything on the schedule. I've got a few things I'm working on that haven't been sold or anything, but maybe some creator-owned stuff. And I'm hoping I can get something going at DC, but I don't know anything for sure yet. So I wish I could hype something, but alas, I cannot.
Well, the one thing I guess we can hype, maybe,
that's right.
is your podcast, which is called Out of Theaters, which is where you of my generation,
that's right.
teaming up with two young punk friends of yours.
Young punks, guys at least 10, 12, 15 years younger than me. Considerably younger, we'll say.
I was saying, I don't want to use the M word, but
well,
people of that generation.
That is the word, yeah. That's the word you want to use.
Basically, you watch a classic movie or something that you have a reason for watching, if it's not like a classic movie. And basically, you expose them to it and you see how they react. And sometimes they react positively.
Yes, and sometimes.
sometimes you show them Gone with the Wind and it goes badly.
Oh, it went so badly. And, you know, I mean, I try to pick movies that I think everyone, if you want to sort of talk about film, you should at least see these movies. You don't have to like them, but you should at least be aware of them and sort of know what they are. And so, yeah, we picked Gone with the Wind, my co-hosts Billy and Kevin definitely did not like that. Now, the one I was most worried about was we watched Billy Wilder's The Apartment, which on a good day is my all-time favorite movie. If I were forced at gunpoint to choose, that may be my favorite movie. And I was very worried that they were going to hate it. And thankfully, the skill of Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon and Fred McMurray and Shirley MacLaine came through, and they liked that movie. So sometimes they like them. They love Casablanca, and sometimes they hate them. They did not like Raiders of the Lost Ark, oddly enough.
It's funny. I was listening to part of that since it was the last episode that you guys did before your hiatus. And I was just like, because I know when you picked it, I'm like, well, at least this is something they, like the week that you picked it, I was like, well, at least they should like this.
Right, yeah, you would think.
And it's funny, and again, this is, you know, generational differences, as it seems funny that they actually found it slow.
Yeah.
When one of the, I don't know if criticisms is, but, like, people used to say Raiders was fast-paced.
Right, because
it went...
Like, too frantic.
Yeah, that it went... Yeah, it went to too many places, and there's lots of these cuts and whatever. And it's like... Again, you know, it's a generation... I was happy that... Because I sent in the suggestion to do Hidden Fortress.
Yes.
Which is a Criterion.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing it full circle.
Yeah,
and
well done.
Yeah, and I think... They kind of liked it.
So.
I mean, they certainly didn't hate it. And I will admit that, you know, that is a movie that is kind of slow.
Right, it's slow. I mean, because on the one hand, yeah, it is a little slow just from its time. On the other hand, it's not like one of Kurosawa's big sort of serious statements. It's supposed to be a rousing adventure movie with comedy and action and everything. So, yeah, I loved it. And I actually think they liked it, too. We loved that princess. She was the greatest.
And you can definitely see, you know, because I'm one of those people who love to joke about how much Lucas stole to make Star Wars.
Yes.
But, you know, and so I like pointing out that, you know, Hidden Fortress is one of these movies that he borrowed liberally from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not really copied, but when you watch it, you can definitely see, yeah, these guys are kind of like R2 and C-3PO, but not really. But
there's a similarity. You know, yeah.
But Mifune is definitely very sort of Han Solo-y, mm-hmm. and the princess is definitely very Princess Leia-y.
Right, because she's like, yeah, she's tough, and you know, she's action. You know, she's tough. You know, cookie, and yeah, there's some similarity to it, but it's not like, I mean, if you watch it, you're not gonna, you know, there's no spaceships and there's no Luke, so it's. Yeah, it holds up. It holds up beautifully, in fact.
No, and if you're going to show somebody a movie that Lucas took some stuff from, I'd rather show them Hidden Fortress than show them Triumph of the Will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We never did that in the podcast.
Although, I remember I got in trouble once, and I had a German film class when I was in grad school, and... I didn't quite defend Riefenstahl, certainly not Triumph of the Will,
mm-hmm.
but I think for that class we watched Triumph of the Will and we watched Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
And I maintain that Olympia is basically the basis of, like, modern sports television filming.
I completely agree.
She invented so much stuff, I mean, because she had carte blanche,
mm-hmm.
so she could do whatever she wanted. But there's so much stuff that she either invented or would inspire later that we know as sort of like sports cinematography, I guess you could say. Because they dug pits in the infield to film the track and field so people could shoot low angles, mm-hmm. especially
for dramatic shot. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, like the hammer and the discus, and they set up, you know, tracks next to the lane so they could film the 100-yard dash parallel instead of just shooting, you know, from above.
Right.
But it's the kind of thing where it's like, if you start trying to defend Riefenstahl, like, some people just will shut you down immediately.
I mean, that's where, you know, I think that's where if you're going to get in a serious discussion of something like film or art or literature or anything, I mean, you know, you have to be able to say, we're not defending her morals, but on a technical level, I mean, look at this, you know, I mean, and it's tough. It's tough to separate that. And it's, but I mean, you know, you have to say, you know, there's some beautiful sequences in this movie visually. Now, morally, they're abhorrent. And, you know, when you think about how these movies got made and what these movies were meant to do, they're terrible. But you can't, you can't just say, well, it's a terrible movie, it doesn't look good, it's a mess, blah, blah, because it's not. And if you do that, you're just denying the power that those movies had, I think.
And you guys had sort of that issue, if people want to go back and listen to the episode you did on Chinatown.
Right. That was I thought that was one of our interesting episodes, because we got in – yeah, we talked really more about Polanski himself than about Chinatown. But there's – you know, and you know, this – I mean, I know all about Polanski, and I've read books about Polanski, and I know all about Chinatown. But I think Billy and Kevin and the podcast audience that we're aiming for, I mean, this isn't like the Criterion cast where everyone is, you know, a film expert coming in. I mean, I think we're dealing with a lot of people who haven't seen these movies and don't know the backstory. So I think it was important to discuss that. And I think usually our favorite episodes are the ones where the discussion kind of goes off in an area we didn't expect.
Did you guys do any Woody Allen movies?
We did Annie Hall, yeah. And
okay. And that's another sort of, you have to separate the artist from the art.
I know, and I honestly can't remember how much we talked about that, the molestation charges and the Sun Yi stuff, and it seems to me we didn't talk about it too much. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, where do you separate the artist from the art? And, you know, I was just watching Hannah and Her Sisters not too long ago, and Sun Yi is in those scenes in Mia Farrow's apartment. And so it's kind of like, you know, it's weird to think that just a couple years after that was made, you know, whatever he did or didn't do with Mia Farrow's daughter. I mean, I remember when he got together with Sun Yi, and that was crazy. I mean, people were just aghast at that. And now they've been together for like 25 years.
That's sort of like when you're talking about Polanski, I think I have that reaction. I mean, she didn't make that many movies, but like, if you see like the one or two movies from like the late 60s that Sharon Tate's in.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can't like turn off, oh my God, that's Sharon Tate, I know what happened. You know, I guess that's true with any sort of lurid true crime.
But it's hard. Yeah, it is hard because Sharon Tate is more known for being killed by the Manson family than for any of her movies. You know, I mean, her movies, she was in what, Valley of the Dolls and a few other, the Fearless Vampire Hunters and a few other movies here and there. But I mean, when you say Sharon Tate, I mean, you think of the Tate LaBianca murders. And, you know, it's a shame, really. I'm always whenever I see Sharon Tate in a film, I'm struck by, she had to be one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood history. I mean, she was just next level gorgeous. And it's, you know, obviously that doesn't make it any worse that she was horribly murdered, but she was just such an iconic figure, and then to be struck down like that, it's just sad.
What's funny is whenever I think of her, and I think there's some connection between the two, but I can't remember what it is right now, but I always think of Barbara Boucher when I think about Sharon Tate, because they're both sort of like striking blondes, mm-hmm. and, you know, she didn't do a lot. I mean, I always remember her from being in what I call the good Casino Royale.
Yeah, I remember I worked at a local theater here where they would, you know, show old movies on the weekends, and I would volunteer to be in the projection booth. And so I remember watching the old Casino Royale twice in a row. And I mean, yeah, it was striking is a good word.
Yeah, I have gotten people to watch that, and people are just like, people can tolerate it or they hate it.
Yeah.
But I think I always say there's a good movie in there.
There is. There's some great sequences, but it's kind of a mess.
But you can tell, obviously, that this is a movie that was made by five different directors.
Mm-hmm.
And was pieced together, and, you know, Wells may or may not have, you know, directed, you know, his part as Le Chief. But if you could, like, sort of snip around it and just sort of make – the other thing, and as we close, we'll go first circle again. It's like, you know, Peter Sellers would have been such a great actual James Bond.
Yeah.
If you could separate knowing that it's Peter Sellers out. You know, because he had already made, I think, one or two of the Pink Panther movies by then. You think he had made Pink Panther and A Shot in the Dark?
I think so, yeah. Those the first two. And then he might have done, like, The Party by then, too.
Well, I remember as a kid, we had one of the local video stores had, like, a weird assortment of, like, random stuff. And, like, the kind of things you would not expect a video store in the mid-80s to have, you know, in the middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, this place ended up getting, like, I'm All Right, Jack, and all this. Like, yeah, when you've only seen him as Inspector Clouseau, and there's all these weird late 50s black and white, I don't know if they were Ealing or not, but, and you're like, is that really the same guy? And yeah, and then you graduate up, and you see Strangelove, you know, and you see Lolita.
Lolita, right. And where he does that perfect Kubrick impersonation in Lolita.
And, you know, and then I guess sort of by the end when you see Being There and you're like, yeah, that was, wow, this guy is so amazingly talented, even, you know, when you remove him from his very silly comedy stuff.
Right. You realize that as the Pink Panther, he was really, you know, slumming it in a lot of ways. I mean, it wasn't touching what he could really do.
So, since we're talking about, I think you teased online the other day when we were talking that there may be some sort of announcement related to the podcast.
Yeah,
that you had.
I can. I've been in conference with Billy since then. Billy Culpa, who he's sort of the brains behind the podcast, and he's the tech guy. We are going to be bringing back Out of Theaters. It's going to be not immediately, but within the next, hopefully, month or so. And then we plan to continue it indefinitely. We all love doing it. It just became kind of a time crunch. So we'll be announcing it on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere. But, yeah, we're definitely going to bring it back. We'll be looking for some movie suggestions if anyone has anything they want us to tackle. The format's going to be pretty much the same, maybe with a few tweaks here and there, but yeah, I could not be more excited because there's nothing I love doing more than arguing about movies.
I would say it's a very fun listen, although I, of course, am basically in your shoes when I listen, and the amount of sort of face-palming.
I know, I have.
Like figurative and sometimes literal about, because again, you know, I went to film school. I have sort of a degree. I was a film critic for a while. But, yeah, it's like there's some, I guess, sacred cows that if you don't know, you know, that Billy can sort of have the Emperor's New Clothes effect.
Right, right. And, I mean,
when you're which is good.
Yeah, it's – I mean, I have the same – you know, I obviously have the same reaction a lot of times because I'm the one arguing. And I have friends who are like – they say, we're just screaming in our iPods when, you know, they don't like this or they don't like that. But I mean, this is what the podcast is. We want a good argument, and we want somebody coming in cold who hasn't, you know, spent all their life praising Citizen Kane to say, wait a minute, why is this movie great? Maybe it's not as great as everyone says it is. And I think that's the fun. It's always fun to look back on something you've seen a bunch of times and try and look at it with new eyes. And I mean, I give Billy tons of credit because he takes a lot of grief from people, but I wouldn't be willing to have somebody just, you know, say, watch all these movies, but he's willing to, you know, put himself out there and see what he thinks and then be honest with his reaction. So,
yeah, I mean, I've certainly a couple of times, like, written on the Facebook page, like, I think once I said, you know, I figured Sleepy just, like, I don't know if I said I wanted to physically slap him or, like, I slapped myself in the head or something. And I didn't mean it in a mean way. It was just like, I can't believe, you know, again, I'm trained to, and I don't remember what, I'm sure it was something like that I hold very dear. You know, it was earlier than Kane, but it was something. And I was just like, how can you not like, you know, some classic or, you know.
Right.
But yeah, it's again, if you're a guy, you know, again, if you're somebody born in 1986 or it's something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like how old Billy and Kevin are. And it's just like, you know, I was already, you know, in college seeing, you know, Birth of a Nation by the time, like, you guys were, you know, still, like, learning to walk or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think one of our most fun episodes was we did battling teen movies with Fast Times at Ridgemont High representing my generation, and they did Can't Hardly Wait, and they literally weren't alive when Fast Times at Ridgemont High came out. So to them, it's this weird 80s period piece, and I'm like, you know, it's fun to see, you know, and to me, the Can't Hardly Wait, it's like, you know, some punk kids making this movie and blah, 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 blah. And so, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Fast Times is one of those when I'm listening that I just, like, I want to just start writing this long, probably film school-y kind of explanation, you know, about certain things that happened in this movie. And it's like, I'm sure they didn't necessarily notice because, you know, again, different experience. But it's like, to them not knowing how revolutionary that movie was.
Right.
Because it was a woman director, and somebody actually got, you know, a girl who had sex actually had to get an abortion. When you think about a movie in 1982.
Yeah, that was shocking back then. It's shocking now. It wouldn't happen now.
No, and the girl, you know, the girls are the POV characters, and yeah, some of the, you know, between the sex and the drugs. Yeah, you probably wouldn't get away with a lot of, you know, you wouldn't even get an R, probably.
I don't think you'd get that abortion plot in as it's handled nowadays. Because at the end, she gets it, and, you know, it's sad, but, you know, then the movie goes on. That's not how the movie ends, you know, then her life goes on, and, you don't see that in movies these days. You barely saw it then.
But yeah, that was such a, you know, to me, that's such a, that, it's funny that, to present that as like an 80s teen comedy movie when that is like the atypical 80s teen comedy in a way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. I mean, if you compare it to Porky's or Losing It or Private School or all of those movies that, you know, I saw as a, I, that you, we both probably saw as a teenage, you know, as teenagers.
And it's, yeah.
But I'm glad the pod is coming back soon. If we didn't say before, the hiatus is because Billy had another kid,
yeah,
so it didn't have time to, you know, whatever. So
yeah, two kids is it's that's a time crunch. So yeah, and I always defer because Billy also did, besides being a good sport at watching those movies, he was our tech guy. I mean, he was the one who recorded everything, you know, mixed it, got it ready, uploaded it, maintained the website. So I had to defer to him. If he said he was too busy, then, you know, he was too busy.
Plus, you guys recorded, like, all three of you together.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Except for, like, I think one episode, which might have been the teen episode, we were always in the same room. So that was, scheduling that could get tricky, too.
Yeah, because I have friends that sort of, because my podcast is sort of when I have the time and I get people lined up and I know they have something they want to talk about. So it's, you know, sort of biweekly-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have friends that sort of are, like, on a regular schedule, like clockwork every week, but, you know, they also have a sort of regimented format, plus they're all on Skype, so it's sort of like, we know we record every Thursday at 8 o'clock, and we record for an hour and a half, and, like, because, like, if it's a comic book podcast, we know what we're going to review, we know what's coming out, we know what TV show we're going to talk about. And so, like, in a way, I sort of envy them that they're regular, but also, I don't know, personally, if I wanted to be so regimented.
It's tough.
That I like, you know, I like that this week we're talking about movies and comics, and last week I talked about hockey, and I'm going to talk to one of my other friends tomorrow about Lucha Libre, and so, you know, like, it's sort of like with the magazine, I like being able to do basically whatever I want.
Right.
Oh, that reminds me. I was going to tell one last story. When we were talking about the age difference,
mm-hmm.
I was talking with a girl I worked with because I was working on an issue of the magazine. And she's like, what's this about? And I'm like, oh, it's pop culture and it's this and this and this and this. And she's like, what's it called? And I said, it's called Odessa Steps Magazine. And she's like,
what's that?
What is that? Oh, that's fine. I'm plenty used to explaining that. And I said, well, there's a famous movie from like 100 years ago that was shot in Russia, and there's a very famous scene, and if you know stuff about like film history, it's very, very important. And then I said, well, they sort of referenced it in Kevin Costner's Untouchables movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I said, you know, there's the scene in the train station where there's a shootout and the baby carriage comes down the stairs and he has to save the baby, I said, that is a reference to the Odessa Steps sequence in this Russian movie. And she's like, I've never seen that. And she's like, when did it come out? And I was like, 1986. And she's like, I was born in 1986.
Oh, I know. That's my life.
And so I'm like, well then, that's why. It's like, if you haven't seen that, then you certainly have not seen Battleship Potemkin.
No, no, no.
So,
yeah. If you haven't seen the reference, we should do Potemkin. Well, I watched Billy's head explode. I want to do silent movie.
Well, see, the thing with Potemkin is, and admittedly I'm biased because, of course, I named my magazine.
Obviously you're a fan.
But that movie's only like 65 minutes long. So it's
not long. Most silent movies, Griffith aside, are not that long.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like you're sitting through like Napoleon, you know, is like 4 hours long. Or, well, that was something I was going to say before. It's like when you pick old stuff for them to watch, like, you're still picking, like, important stuff, but generally watchable stuff. Like, you know, I wouldn't, like, ask Billy to sit through Last Year at Marion Bad.
No, I mean, I try and pick things,
you know,
I think they're going to enjoy. And I think most people would enjoy. You know, I'm not trying to trick them or anything.
But, yeah, but I think, like, the right silent movie, especially if it's, like, maybe something they've heard of,
mm-hmm.
or... You know, like if you do Chaplin or Keaton.
I think if we do one, the one I've always thought about doing is The General, because I figure it's very well known, it's very funny, and it's visually impressive. I mean, when you watch that movie, a lot of times you're like, wow. I showed my own daughter, who is just turned 11, when she was 10 years old, I showed her Keaton's Seven Chances, and she loved it. The younger generation can enjoy a silent movie if you present it to them correctly, I think.
Well, I think you also have to get over the misnomer that it's a silent movie.
Right.
Like, if you have, like, the DVD that has the appropriate accompaniment with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because sure. I remember when I was in Bloomington, one year, there was touring around the country. There was somebody, they were showing Nosferatu,
mm-hmm.
and they had a guy who came and played the organ while you watched the movie. You know, that was like they did that one year for Halloween, and that was
mm-hmm.
cool as hell. You know, like that's the kind of thing. I'm sure, like if you guys watch Nosferatu for Halloween, that would probably be something. Or you know, like if you did Great Dictator. Oh no, that's 40. That's got sound.
Mm-hmm.
Was, you know, like that's, you know Gold yeah, Rush or you know they know. I think I presume they know who Charlie Chaplin is. They kind of you know.
Oh yeah, they know.
Do, you know. I will say the one I think I've recommended this once or twice over the length of the podcast. So when you guys come back, I would love to see you guys. I would love to see you guys do Rollerball because
I love Rollerball.
I think I
bought that expensive like $40 Blu-ray that they put out. I forget who put it out, but Code Red or somebody. But oh, I love Rollerball
because I love explaining to people like. This movie was so prescient about where sports mm-hmm. went in the United States because it's got hyper-violence, it's got greed. Like, all the teams are owned by corporations, which in the 70s was crazy. You know,
but
like,
now,
you had Warner. It's not what they do. You know, it's violence, it's made for television, it's opiates for the masses, it's sex, it's... All the players are drugged up. So it's – to me, it's like if you want to encapsulate like what football in 21st century America is like, it's Rollerball.
Yeah, I agree. I love that movie. Maybe we could do that like Super Bowl weekend or something.
That would be cool. And, yeah, so like I'm glad the podcast is coming back. People can look for it. I should also mention –
Yeah, .com is our website, and I'm sure we'll have all kinds of announcements there.
Out of theaters, and you've also got your X-Ray Specs blog, which I almost forgot to mention, which is where you post movie reviews and whatever floats your boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just I've been writing that for like 11 or 12 years now. I got into blogging early, and I may be one of the few people still doing it. But, yeah, I love writing that blog.
Yeah, so people can check out all of that kind of stuff. Will, I want to thank you very much for your time.
This was great. Thank you very much, Mark.
We'll talk to everybody next time.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.